Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
You know, black men in particular are more highly represented in the victim category.
Yes, they are. 90% of the homicide victims are people of color.
And in the suspect category. And we know that. And other places that do this work find similar outcomes.
That is the voice of a man you've never heard on this show before, and not because we haven't asked for an interview, but that is Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle, who came on the job not quite 2.5 years ago. And yeah, we started asking for an interview with Chief Chuck. Before that, we got it finally today. You're going to hear it later on this hour. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. This is honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest, and we're glad to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And if you want to join the great conversation we provide every day, we call it the best conversation in talk journalism, you're certainly welcome. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our Twitter poll. As I said, we'll be airing the interview that I got this morning with Chief Chuck Lavelle of the Portland Police Bureau. As you know, I've written a lot about him. I've had a lot to say about him. Seems like a reasonably nice guy. Whether or not he's doing a great job, well, that's up to the taxpayers. But from a distance, I don't think the job is getting done. I think that citizens are paying a lot of money in taxes, $250 million being spent on one police agency. And are they getting the public safety they pay for? I'd say no, but you're going to hear the chief's answer to that a little bit later on this hour. Our Twitter poll, though, has to do specifically with Washington State, although Oregon has similar plans. You see, the state of Washington has a new cap and trade tax. It's being applied, and it's going to raise the cost of gasoline and diesel. And if you've been hearing today that OPEC has just announced it will cut its production by 2 million barrels a day, that is going to leave a mark. It is going to affect gasoline prices. In fact, the minute OPEC announced that it was going to cut its production, you saw some of the gasoline futures or oil futures go up immediately. So it has to occur to you, if on January 1 of this coming year, 2023, the state of Washington is going to impose this new cap and trade tax. It's supposed to save the planet from global warming and all the usual hoo-ha that you hear from the global warming true believers. Do you know what it's going to do? The best estimates say it is going to add 46 cents per gallon on top of Washington State's current 49 cents per gallon in state gas taxes, another almost 20 cents in federal gas taxes, and all of that on top of whatever the oil markets deliver. Now, do we know what the price of gas is going to be in January? It may be that by then, Bidenflation has so crushed the economy that maybe we'll actually see a dramatic drop in demand, although that's probably going to mean a drop in a lot of your paychecks as well. So I want to ask you the question this way. Should Washington State go forward with plans to add 46 cents a gallon to gasoline taxes January 1st of next year? It's only a couple of months away, and I want you to consider that the folks in Olympia in this case could say, this is really a dumb time to add almost half a dollar to the cost of every single gallon of gasoline or diesel, save the planet or not. So I would say no, They should not go forward with it, and there is certainly time between now and January 1 for the legislature to meet and say, this is a crazy time. We're heading into a recession. We've got already stratospheric energy costs. Adding another 46 cents a gallon is the height of foolishness. And by the way, when I invite phone calls, we always tell you that naysayers go to the head of the line. I'd be glad to have a naysayer call in and say, why, yes, we should punish the people of Washington State. I happen to be one of them, and yes, I do buy gasoline by the gallon. So I've got a dog in the fight. But is there any good reason to do this, to add a cap-and-trade scheme that's going to jack up your gasoline costs higher than they already are? And if you haven't noticed, they're going up, and they were going up even before the announcement yesterday that OPEC is going to cut back on its oil production, and that's going to raise costs even more. But I want to mention this to you first. There is something very important going on in the Oregon governor's race, because it is becoming more and more clear that Christine Drazen, the GOP nominee, is going to win. And this has the liberals panicked right now. There are now four polls out there, and all of them show similar results. They show Drazen ahead of Democrat Tina Kotek by anywhere from 1% to 5%. And of course, Betsy Johnson, the independent candidate, it's unique that we have a serious independent candidate, but she continues to pull up in a distant third at 19%. And I've been pointing out to my friends in politics, including both some Democrats who are enthusiastic about Betsy Johnson and some Rhino Republicans who've said, no, I'm not going to vote for the GOP nominee. I'm going to vote for the former Democrat Betsy Johnson, the pro-abortion Betsy Johnson, the Betsy Johnson who is always a stalwart on Second Amendment and NRA issues, who has considerably softened her position. In all of those polls, she pulls about 18 or 19%. Now, let's do a little simple math here. Can she win? Well, yes, if she could, within the next 60 days, add about 75% to her current level of support. If somehow in the next 60 days she can add 75%, she will be competitive with the other two. The problem is they're only about 11% undecided at this point. At this point, in the latest poll out from Emerson College, 36% of voters support Christine Drazen, the GOP. Tina Kotek, who is clearly panicked, gets 34%. That's 70% right there. Johnson takes 19. That only leaves 11 percentage points of undecided. Now, unless you see something dramatic happen in the next 60 days, the ballots are going in the mail in just a couple of weeks. Election Day, I know we still call it Election Day, even though there is really no Election Day these days. Election Day is coming up in just over a month. Now, there was a debate, and both Tina Kotek and Christine Drazen were featured. I found most bizarre the soundbite from Tina Kotek, former Speaker of the Oregon House. She wants a meth daycare center. Listen to this.
I will say for Portland in particular, in addition to making Measure 110 work, we need a meth stabilization center in Portland. We need a place for cops to take folks, not the emergency departments, when they are in a meth-related psychosis.
Hold on a second. Don't take them to jail. Don't take them to the emergency room. Take them to a meth stabilization center. And by the way, in case you didn't know this, Tina Kotek, the police can't just take you somewhere. You can voluntarily go with them. And there are two other ways the cops can take you anywhere. They can arrest you if they believe and have evidence that you've committed a crime, and then they take you to jail. If they believe that you're a danger to yourself or others, they can take you to a hospital emergency room or a secure lockup. But Tina Kotek wants a meth daycare center where people who are psychotic and high on drugs, does that sound like that might not work out well? That you're going to just pick them up without any legal authority and drop them off. And by the way, Tina Kotek slammed Governor Kate Brown at least a couple of times. They're not exactly friends, but she hasn't slammed her up till now. It may be that Tina Kotek is realizing the writing's on the wall. She's going to lose this race, and she's getting desperate. Back in just a moment, I'll get to your phone calls, emails, and the Northwest nonsense on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I got to share this letter with you. I got it from a gentleman who is a farmer in Sherman County here in the Pacific Northwest. He said, Lars, I've watched the evolution of the wind turbines since the first ones were installed above the John Day Dam in the 80s. They rarely, if ever, turned. Around 2000, things took off when the tax code benefits were passed. I don't know how many turbines there are in Klickitat, Sherman, and Gilliam counties, but it must be enough that the whole place lights up at night with synchronized safety lights. The thing you don't hear about from the green advocates is that many of the turbines have already reached the end of their useful life in 20 years or so. The following, and he sent some pictures, are from BNK Rigging in Caldwell, Idaho. Their original contract was for 3,000 to 3,500 tons. The companies begged them to take more, so they are up to about 5,000 tons, and they told the windmill companies they can't take any more. They have a crew of four people, cutting torch folks, going through 3,000 gallons of oxygen and a certain amount of propane, cutting them up every week. They process about 250 tons per week. No carbon footprint there. A gearbox weighs 46,000 pounds, and they don't get top dollar because some of the metal is over 4 inches thick, takes extra energy to melt it down. One other thing to note, the blades can't be recycled because they're carbon fiber, so they're filling up the landfills. It's my understanding that the Arlington landfill has shut them off, as they can read the writing on the wall. So what do you want to do? My friend says the blades are cut into three sections and hauled off to Spokane. Then they're loaded on a train and transported to Illinois and dropped in a landfill there. What a joke. The biggest problem, in my opinion, the general public takes a turbine at face value when they drive by it and they get all warm and fuzzy. Not many people these days know how things work, meaning the mining overseas for the ore to build the turbine, the transportation, the construction, and now disposing of what I consider to be a relatively short-lived piece of equipment. The John Day Dam has three holes that have never had generators installed. They were built for expansion. They could be 150 megawatts each, so 450 megawatts of 24/7 power. But that's not green energy because the project produces over 65 megawatts of power. That was conveniently written into the legislation. Conspiracy? You decide. Best regards, Darren. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
The way has been paved by Trademark Paving. Just pave it. Serving Southwest Washington.
I can tell you that we have talked about this Richard Gilmore creep a number of times. The man known as the Jogger Rapist. He's going to walk out of prison this December after serving his maximum sentence. And you say, how did that happen? This is a guy who aspired to be a cop, then admitted to 9 rapes, but he was only convicted of one because the statute of limitations ran out by the time he was arrested in 86. Originally sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison for ambushing and raping a 13-year-old in her Gresham home. And we've talked to his victims as well. But in the late 80s, the Oregon Parole Board cut his sentence in half. In 2016, they voted 4-0 against giving him any more parole hearings before his scheduled release in 2023. Then they announced at the time they'd release him on January 1, 23, instead of November 29 of that year, when his sentence will be fully served. Now he's set to be released on December the 16th. He is 63. He has spent almost 36 years in prison. One of the teenagers he raped, Danielle Tudor, says that Gilmore broke into her Gresham house and raped her in 1979, and he's going to walk out of prison. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Tom Lee writes in, Lars, you said the Democrat judges in Oregon should be ashamed of themselves for the scam they're pulling on the voters. The only problem is you and I know they have no shame nor any morals. I think the only way to stop this, and what he means is, where judges retire in the middle of their term, even though they're not sick or incapacitated, and then they let a Democrat governor appoint their replacement. One of the members of the Oregon Supreme Court just did that, I think because he fears there will be a Republican in the governor's office in January. He wanted to give Kate Brown one more pick so she can cheat the voters. Tom writes, I think the only way to stop this is passing a law that says anybody appointed to a position, be a judge or dog catcher, they're not allowed to run for re-election because they were never elected, they were appointed. If they do a good job, sit out a term, and then want to run, so be it. Signed, Tom Lee. To your calls now. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go first to John. John, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Lars. I'm calling from Rhododendron. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm an ER nurse, 28 years, and I have taken many dozens of patients, meth-induced. They come in the same way, four-point restraint, hood up, speaking in a language that hasn't been heard in thousands of years, along with the AMR ambulance and a Gresham police officer. They had the same thing to tell me. They can't look me in the eye. They shuffle their weight, put the foot, and they say, John, he's just too dangerous to bring to jail. So he brings him to me in the ER to take care of. And if Tina Kotek thinks deal with some type of meth clinic, she's out of her mind.
And I think you're right. I mean, the very fact that in her answer, I mean, she just ginned up this idea of a meth daycare center and said for people who are in a psychosis. So you've got somebody who's psychotic, and it sounds like you know what's going on there, and they're high on drugs, and you're not going to take them to jail where they can be contained. You're not going to take them to a mental hospital where they can be contained. You're just going to pick them up and take them to a meth daycare center, a meth stabilization center, as Tina Kotek describes it. Kotek describes it. It's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, basically you do is you put them on a monitor, you give them IM medication to sedate them, and then you watch them for 24 hours. You clean them up because they incontinent bowel and bladder, you know, and then 24 hours later they're a different human being. You come and you see them again 3 weeks later.
Well, except that what you just described, John, could easily be done. I'm sure the hospital emergency rooms don't want to do it, and I don't blame them. But if you've got somebody and you say, we have to give them some IV drugs, we have to give them some intramuscular drugs, we've got to administer drugs to them, what you're talking about is a medical facility. But she says specifically, absolutely. Don't take them to the emergency room. Don't take them to jail. We're going to recreate a separate emergency room that is going to be on standby 24 hours a day, seven days a week for all the meth heads out there. If that sounds cheap, I think you'd be surprised. If it sounds sensible, I think you're crazy. But it's Tina Kotek's latest idea. Coming up in just a moment. After 2.5 years of asking, I finally got an interview with the chief of police for the city of Portland. I want you to hear what he had to say. I want you to hear the questions I asked, and we'll get your phone calls and emails after that. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I never stopped asking for an interview with Chief Chuck Lavelle of the Portland Police, and this morning I finally landed it. Chief, it's good to see you in person at long last.
Yes, good to see you too.
Now, I want to ask you something, just straight out of the box. Are Portlanders getting the public safety that they're paying for right now?
Well, I think as a city, we're doing our best to deal with the public safety challenges we have. As an organization, we wish we had more staffing and the ability to give them more service, but we've really consolidated a lot of our efforts towards answering 911 calls and gun violence, and we're out there doing the best we can.
So what does it say when your boss was one of those who voted to take some of those resources away and listen to the mob in the streets that said defund the cops?
Well, for us as police, we deal with whatever the legislature comes up with, whatever elected officials put in place, and our job is to adapt and do the public safety role. Elected officials have to make tough decisions, and we're in a position where we have to respond and deal with the ramifications of the decisions.
Well, let me ask you about homicide specifically, because the change has been dramatic. So the first year that
Ted Wheeler was mayor, 27 homicides. And that was actually up from the year before, which had been, I think, 20 homicides. Last year, it was 90. This year, we look like we're on track for 100. So we broke a big record last year. Another record may be broken this year. Is 27 the norm we need to get back to? Or are you going to tell Portlanders you're going to have to adapt to a new normal, and the new normal is 70 or 80 or 90 homicides, two murders every single week?
You know, I think the last 10 years or so prior to 2020, we were in the 20s and 30s for homicides. And I think you're right, we're on pace this year to be slightly above last year's total. But I don't think that's necessarily something we need to get used to as Portlanders. We're working really hard to address that with our focus intervention team and our community partners. I think apathy is one of the threats that's out there, accepting kind of what we have today as the norm going forward. There's a lot of people working really hard to bring that number down. And we talk about it in terms of numbers, but I always want to remind people, we're talking about families, people in the community, loved ones, relatives, friends who are no longer here. So, I mean, that's what keeps us going as an organization, trying to keep the next family from having to deal with that heartache. And we're hoping to bring that number down as we grow.
Can you point to any place in America where something like FIT has actually made a difference with violent crime? I don't like to call it gun crime because I think there's a person behind that gun. And in fact, I think the term distracts from the fact that we need to arrest the people and stop the people who are doing these violent crimes. But is there any place else in America where the FIT team approach has worked as opposed to, say, arresting the bad guys and getting them prosecuted?
Well, the FIT team does arrest people and get them prosecuted. I think we should be clear on that. For me, I think there's a lot of places that are struggling with this issue throughout the country. The approach we've taken with FIT adds in a community component. We have the FITCOG, or Community Oversight Group, that is part of that work. I think that's one of the things that was missing here when we had our previous iterations of the Gun Violence Reduction Team. There's really no community voice or component to it that really talked about how the work was being done. People just looked at the numbers as far as stops and things of that nature, and there was really no qualitative assessment of how that work was actually being done.
Okay, but part of the problem from my point of view, and I want to know your point of view, is that political correctness is getting in the way of stopping violent crime. When I talk to the FBI and they say, well, 2/3 of the murders in Portland specifically are done by gangs, and most of those gangs are made up of people of color. And yet the mob in the streets has been saying, stop arresting black men, stop arresting Hispanic men, you're arresting too many, let them go, that the two work at counter purposes, how do you get past that?
It's difficult because we run into that argument frequently.
Are you arresting too many black men or Hispanic men?
We're arresting the people that are responsible for crime. For us, it's irregardless of their color, their ethnic background. We want to arrest and take off the streets the people that are victimizing the community, shooting other people, and causing harm. What we find, though, when we go to do that work and focus on that work, it doesn't line up with community demographics. And a lot of people want to talk about, you know, the community has this many white people, this many black people, this many Hispanic people, and your arrests look like this. But for us, it's really the focus is on taking people who are committing crimes off the street and getting them out of the community into the appropriate situation.
Well, Chief, I want to challenge that because should the arrests reflect the community? For example, in the Oregon State prisons right now, 90% of the people there are men and only 10% are women. Would you try to make it fit that way and say, well, we need to arrest a whole lot more women and we need to let a whole lot more men go if you followed the demographics of the community? In case you didn't know, the women actually outnumber us.
No, I don't think we should focus on the demographics. We should go where the information and the leads and the investigation takes us. And we see there are many things that are disproportionate to the population in society. You look at graduation rates, you look at health outcomes, many, many, many things. And then in police work, you know, when we try to focus on gun violence, we find that it's disproportionate to the demographics as well. And we still operate and do our best to address that. But we still have to come back and explain the stop data piece, the demographics piece frequently.
Well, Chief, when I look at the national numbers, and not just during or before or after the pandemic, the FBI's Uniform Crime Report says black men make up about 6.5% of the population, but they do about 50% of the homicides and about 60% of the armed robberies. Isn't it time to throw the political correctness and the wokeness out and say, we're just going to arrest the people who do the crimes? And if we happen to arrest a lot of people of color, so be it.
Well, I think the numbers would suggest that, you know, black men in particular are more highly represented in the victim category.
Yes, they are. 90% of the homicide victims are people of color.
And in the suspect category. And we know that. And other places that do this work find similar outcomes. So we have to stay focused on who's actually perpetrating the crimes and hold them accountable.
Are you doing that now?
We are. We had, you know, three arrests that we made over the weekend when we had the four homicides. And we were able to arrest three people. And I think that's always been our focus. We've run into some challenges by folks because of the demographics, but that doesn't change our willingness and our ability and focus to go out and do our jobs.
Chief Lavelle, you mentioned that you're in an environment where you've got a lot of different factors acting on this. Governor Kate Brown cut loose more than 1,000 convicted criminals from prison. Did that make Portland more dangerous?
Well, I think anytime you have more people who are committing crimes in an area, it's going to be busier. And if they're committing violent crimes, it could be more dangerous. But I think for us, we get a lot of, hey, you're not arresting enough people. Then we arrest people. People are like, hey, you're arresting people, but they're not staying in jail. And it's like, we focus on our part of the system. It's never been our piece to decide who gets charged or how long they stay in jail. We focus on finding people who are committing crimes and holding them accountable.
All right, Chief, you nicely led into the next thing I wanted to ask you about. You've got a district attorney a few blocks from here. I guess he's that direction instead of that direction now. But you've got a DA who declined to prosecute more than 1,000 accused criminals that were charged by or originally arrested by your police department. Is he making the city more dangerous? And if so, are you and the mayor going to say something about it? Because maybe you've said something about it, but I haven't heard you say the DA isn't prosecuting people we're arresting for crimes, and that's creating a public safety problem.
You know, I work very closely with the DA. He and I meet regularly. We're actually meeting tomorrow. We talk about cases. Would I like to him to have prosecuted more cases at a certain time? Sure, but that's not our place to our decision to make. He makes his decisions on his side. We make our decisions on the arrest. But to the extent that I'm going to spend my time arguing back and forth with the DA, I don't think it's necessarily productive. And
why not? We're going to be back in just a moment with the rest of the interview I did with Chief Chuck Lavelle today. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I want to tell you something. I've been asking for 2.5 years for an interview with the chief of police. I'd love to get one with Adrian Diaz up in Seattle as well, although he's just now become or soon to become the permanent police chief up there, so we'll start the mission there. But with Chief Chuck Lavelle of Portland, I wanted to be able to ask him a bunch of questions. And I told him I've got about 2.5 years of questions built up. But we got to one of the key ones in that last segment. I want to play this next one, which we recorded just a couple of hours ago because I have to make accommodations for the schedules of people I'm talking to. Because Chuck Lavelle says he's meeting with the DA, Mike Schmidt, tomorrow. He meets with him regularly. And he says, but it's not my place to tell him if he decides not to prosecute the people we arrest. You see, that's a place I disagree with Chuck Lavelle. I think the chief of police should be using the bully pulpit. And if his people, his officers, are arresting people for crimes and the DA says, I won't prosecute them, I think the chief should use the bully pulpit to demand an answer, a why. Take a listen. Why isn't it good if you're saying we're arresting people for crimes and you're letting them go? That seems like a component of what you just spoke about. People saying you keep arresting people, but they're not being held in custody. They're not being charged. They're not being convicted. And they're not being sent off for punishment. Isn't that part of your job to use the bully pulpit that you have and maybe that your boss has to call out the DA and say, do your job?
You know, I'm not an elected official, one. But also, you know, for me, I think there are a lot of things we're working on together. We work very closely with the deputy DAs, our investigators and detectives to do cases. We prosecute a lot of, we help them prosecute a lot of cases. There are a lot of good people over there doing good work. And I think, you know, to that extent, we have a decent working relationship to do the jobs we're appointed to do.
Chief, is that really what you think when you send over a bunch of charged individuals and they all get declined to prosecute? Is that really what you say to yourself?
You know, I think now they are doing the best they can to prosecute people. Are they really?
You really mean that?
I do. I have a lot of conversations with deputy DAs, people in the DA's office, and they're working hard to do prosecutions. We work with them every day to do prosecutions. If you're talking about, you know, historically back to 2020, maybe that time it was different, but I think today we're really doing good work together as best we can.
You mean back when Mike Schmidt was saying, in the interests of justice, we can't charge this person, we can't prosecute this person. He was letting people go for what seemed like highly political reasons.
Well, you know, the DA has that purview. They're the ones that make the charging decisions. We make arrests, present them to the DA's office, and they've always been the ones that get to make those decisions.
I want to ask you about Measure 110. Did the passage of Measure 110 and the effective legalization of hard drugs in Oregon, did that make the city more dangerous?
I think that presented more challenges, but I think for us, we are in a position where we adapt to the laws that are put in place, either at the state level, the city level, and our job is to deal with them from a law enforcement perspective. But I do think that that has presented more challenges for us.
Would it make the city safer? Would it make the state safer if you were to revoke Measure 110, if the voters or the legislature were to revoke 110 and put some laws back on hard drugs?
It's hard to say. I think you have to look at this in terms of a system, the criminal justice system as a whole. We're one part. The DA is one part. There are judges. There's parole and probation. There's, you know, public defenders. All these make up a system. And I think all of those pieces of the system have to be functioning efficiently if we're actually going to see some progress.
One last question, and that is the charge from the mobs in the streets has been America is systemically racist, and the institutions of America, including police agencies and cities, are systemically racist. You're a black man. Is this a systemically racist bureau that you've worked in for a long time until you went from lieutenant to chief?
I don't think so. I've been here 21 years almost, and there are some of the finest people I've ever worked with and been around in my life that work here, care about the city, go out every day, put themselves in danger to protect the city. I think there are some systemically wrong things almost everywhere, but I don't think we as a bureau are systemically racist.
Chief, thank you very much. Now, we had to operate within some tight time constraints, about 15 minutes, and I did tell the chief I'd love to get him on the show for a longer interview, and maybe we can make that happen as well. But I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well. If you want to jump into the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS, and naysayers go first. Let's go to Ron in Salem. Hey, Ron, what'd you make of Chief Chuck Lavelle?
I'm telling you right now, it's like having Chief Ed Davis 49 years ago in L.A. Worthless, cheap, dishonorable, lazy, trifling, not doing his duties as he was promised to serve, and at the same time enabling the criminals, this drug situation, the child snatching, and all this other. I had a Cadillac converter. This is how bad it is, Lars. I'm in the South Valley. Cadillac converter, stolen. Bicycle wheel, stolen. I got sideswiped on my Power Stroke diesel. It's a mess. The front end is about $6,000 damage in less than 3 weeks. And this is the answers I get from this? This is a Bernie Schiff moment. I cannot understand, Lars. We need prayer.
And I'll tell you, Ron, think about this. In Seattle right now, you remember all the windows that got broken of businesses in downtown Portland and Seattle? You know what they're doing now? They're spending millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money. So in other words, Antifa and BLM come in and break the windows, and then the city fathers and city moms say, why, we'll just take some money from the taxpayers, who are the ones who are attacked, and we'll pay to replace the windows instead of going after Antifa for doing the deed. Ron, thanks for the call. It's the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours?
Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. It's the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Our Twitter poll today: should Washington State go forward with its plans on January 1 of next year to add 46 cents a gallon to gasoline taxes? I'd say no. And if you wonder, what are they doing? Is it January 1, 2023, the state of Washington's new cap and trade tax? I know, the one that's supposed to save the planet from global warming. It's going to add almost half a buck per gallon to whatever the gas prices are by then. And based on what's happening with OPEC and the non-drilling ordered by Joe Biden, they might be quite high by then, so add another half a buck, you're going to strand an awful lot of people. In any case, you can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, we've been featuring a number of people running for political office because I want you to hear what these people have to say as they seek office in Oregon and Washington and Idaho. Ben Edel is running as a Republican to fill a Senate seat in Oregon's 19th legislative district, and he joins me now. Ben, welcome to the program, and tell me, if you get in the Oregon Senate, what are you going to do with it?
Well, the first thing, by the way, Lars, thank you very much for having me on. Look, the first thing we have to do is we have to repeal over 27 bills that drove up the cost of living on every Oregonian that hurts the lowest income earners the most. We have to repeal the 12 to 16 bills that were passed to completely demoralize and defund our public safety infrastructure, including the bail reform bill, which gives DAs like Mike Schmidt the ability to release Measure 11 offenders, like rapists, armed robbers, even murderers, back onto the streets while they await trial. This is just an absolute humanitarian crisis in Portland, and the only way to fix it is to vote people in that are going to clean up our streets and protect Oregonians.
I take it one of your targets would be the so-called cat tax that raised, I think it was $1 billion a year, almost $2 billion every biennium. Would you be in favor of repealing that as well?
I mean, that's the first thing we're going to need to repeal in terms of reducing the cost of living in Oregon. Look, Rob Wagner, the guy I'm running against, is the Senate Majority Leader. That means that he's responsible to shape the legislative agenda, okay? So these bills are coming directly from him. And one of the thing that people need to realize about the cat tax is it's not a normal sales tax. It's a gross revenue tax on every business in Oregon that makes over $1 million a year in gross revenue, right, which is all the commodities that we depend on: energy, food, clothing, building supplies, everything that we depend on. And it's not just a sales tax like you pay in California where it's 7.5% at retail. It actually compounds through the entire supply chain. It is absolutely devastating to our state, and it's why Oregon is the fifth most expensive state to live in the country, and we're heading very fast to becoming number one.
Ben Edel is running for a Senate seat in Oregon's 19th legislative district. Don't forget to mention pharmacy in there, because as I understand the facts, Bi-Mart basically said, we're closing down all of our pharmacies. And when people said, why? Isn't that a good business? They said, with the cat tax that's on gross sales, I mean, a pharmacy might gross a gigantic amount of money. We all know how expensive prescription drugs are. But that doesn't mean the pharmacy is making big money on it. It just means those products are flowing in. If you're selling, you know, pills that cost $1,000 a bottle, the pharmacy has to pay the cat tax on it, even though the pharmacy isn't getting the $1,000 a bottle. They get some fraction of that as the payment for processing the prescription. And it basically wiped out an entire chain of pharmacies and made that a lot harder for people. So, Ben, I'm with you. I want to ask you, how are you going to deal with this, that you're likely to be in a Senate that still has a Democrat majority and the House is going to have the same? So how do you get past that?
Look, I think you just have to tell the truth, right? And that's what I'm doing at BenEdel.com. At BenEdel.com/Wagner, I have all his bills listed, all the bills that he passed. You can click them and go directly to the Oregon Legislative Information System and read them yourself. If we can expose how literally evil these people are in Salem, then the voters and the citizens, the Oregonians, will not put up with it, and we can put enough pressure on them to make change. Let me tell you something. I lost all my family businesses in Portland in 2020 due to lockdowns and lawlessness and riots. And since January 2021, I founded a group called Free Oregon that we became the largest civil rights group in the state. We took Kate Brown and Pat Allen, the Oregon Health Authority, the state of Oregon, and other corporate civil rights violators to federal court, where all of our cases are continuing to this day. And we amassed 20,000 Oregonians that are Democrat, not affiliated, and Republican to push back. And that's why I'm here. I got to sit down yesterday with Rob Wagner himself, the leader of the majority of the Senate, at Willamette Week, and we destroyed him. He was bumbling. He was struggling to answer. He could not answer for his record, and his record is online on my website at BenEdel.com/Wagner. You got to.
And by the way, Ben, I've got friends at Willamette Week. I don't always agree with them, but the videos of those candidate interviews are really telling. I'm going to see if my producers can put up the link on our website at LarsLarson.com. You may have it, Ben Edel. And people, you should know, the last name is spelled E-D-T-L. I actually looked up the history of your family name. Apparently, there are only 3 Edel families in the whole country, and 75% of you are all related. So it sounds like...
we're all related.
you can't swing a dead cat anywhere without hitting a Larson somewhere, but Edel is kind of a rare commodity.
It's very rare. It's a weird name, but you know what? It's unique. You can remember it.
All right, so what else are you going to get done? Because that's what I care most about. I mean, I want people to win who are conservatives, but once they're in, I want them to get things done. So what else do you plan to get done if you make it into the Oregon Senate?
Look, I got to tell you, we have to change the Republican Party in Oregon. The leader of the Republican Minority Caucus is the lowest-ranked conservative in the legislature. You've got people like Kim Thatcher and Dennis Linthicum who are ranked high by CPAC, right? They're the highest ranked. The guy that runs the Republican Caucus, Tim Knope, he's the lowest-ranked. He's one above Betsy Johnson, who there's nothing against Betsy Johnson because she's an honest liberal, I think. Nothing's wrong with that. But I'll tell you, when our leadership in our party is essentially so moderate that they're likely a Democrat, how are they in charge of the infrastructure of our party? And I'll tell you this, the job of a senator is not just to vote yes and no on bills. The job of a senator is to build the political infrastructure in their district. And I'm in District 19, so it's South Portland, Lake Oswego, Westland, Tualatin. And we have a ton of city council people, school board members that are on the left. And we have to be able to get conservative, like-minded people in charge of those positions. And that's what I'll be doing a lot of the work of
you know
the
what?
Next 4 years.
I'm so glad to hear that, Ben, because you've got Republicans in Oregon and they're saying, vote for Betsy Johnson, and she can't win. You've got Republicans in Washington State, where I live, and they're actually out going doing meet and greets for Democrats. That's Ben Edel, spelled E-D-T-L. Ben Edel running for the Oregon Senate in the 19th Legislative District. Back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. I know a lot of you want to comment. 866-HEY-LARS. It's the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. You can answer our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com if you're not a big fan of Twitter. Although, once Elon Musk takes over Twitter, maybe it'll change its operations and become even more successful when it stops trying to lock out all the conservative points of view. Anyway, glad to take your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. And as we always say, naysayers go first. Let's go first to John, who's a naysayer. Hey, John, thanks for listening. What do you and I disagree about today?
Well, this is John the Electrician, and you are the Ministry of Truth yourself.
Okay, I'll take that as a compliment, I guess.
Well, the song is talking about you. Anyway,
I don't think so. I know Buddy Brown, and he's actually talking about the Ministry of Truth that was said to be established by the Biden administration, and I'm not part of that. So go ahead.
I know the story. So if I can do this, and it's succinct and it's quick, fast.
Well, let's hope.
Before you start to overtalk me. Okay, yeah. So this is about Ukraine, Russia, and your criticism of Ukraine, which goes on and on, that they're Nazis, and barely a word, and you've even criticized our country lately, the biggest criticism I've heard you say, and this is, I listen a fair amount.
Are we ever going to get to the point where you and I disagree about something? Because you claim you're a naysayer, so go ahead.
You're already over-talking me. It is that you are not a big fan of Vladimir Putin. That doesn't speak to the millions of lives that have been disrupted, the death and destruction that his artillery and missiles and
if you're saying I haven't objected enough, I've objected plenty to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It was wrong.
I really don't hear it. You don't listen enough. No, I listen all the time. Your criticism of Ukraine goes on and on.
Would you like to know why?
We have Nazis in this country. Would you say
really
that
where?
Ukraine, that Russia, they were wearing MAGA hats, some of them on Jan 6. Oh, my God.
I don't think those were Nazis. But if you want to call the people.
Fascists and Nazis that come from the right, they were all over around the Capitol on Jan 6. They march with Confederate flags.
Why do you describe them as? I'm just wondering, what is it they've said that makes you think they're part of the National Socialist Party, the Nazis from Germany, who were mass murderers? I don't know of any mass murderers on January 6th. Do you?
Well, there's plenty of skinheads and white nationalists in this country. So I've got off topic, and now we're.
Yes, you did. Let's get back to the point. See if you can get to your objection. Otherwise, I'm going to go elsewhere.
The point is, Larson, that country has been invaded by Russia, and you really kind of don't go on and on about that, but you go on.
I've gone on and on about how Americans are now forced to fund Ukraine, which has been a gigantic money laundry for the Democrat Party and a big moneymaker for the Biden crime family.
We should help Ukraine. We should help Ukraine against Russia, because that's just disgusting what they've done. I don't hear the disgust from your voice. All I hear
that's your big naysayer is to say don't hear enough disgust from me. Is that the objection?
That's a huge part of it.
Okay, well then I'll try to sound more disgusted in the future. But John, that's not much of a naysayer call, but that's okay. 866-439-5277. Let's go to Pete. Hey Pete, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi there, Lars. I just have one quick question. I'd like to get your opinion of it. How honest do you think the Oregon mail-in voting system is?
It's not. I mean, if you want a short answer, it's not. It has huge flaws to it. And one of the commitments I got from both Betsy Johnson and Christine Drazen, but not from Tina Kotek, is that if one of them becomes governor, and I believe Christine Drazen will, sadly, Betsy Johnson is not even going to finish, you know, as a close third, because the polls say that she's way out of the running. But both of them committed that they would demand a full forensic audit of Oregon elections. I think the same thing should be done in Washington state, because the vote-by-mail system has gigantic flaws in it. It has gigantic opportunities for fraud. And we haven't cleaned up our voter rolls. We have literally thousands, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of ballots going out to people who don't exist, who aren't alive, who don't live in the state anymore, any number of reasons they shouldn't be on the voter rolls. And Oregon refuses to clean up the voter rolls. Dennis Richardson, the former Secretary of State, was, I think, on the way to cleaning that up, but sadly died of cancer. I'd love to see that problem cleaned up. But I don't know that it's going to get, it certainly won't get done under Tina Kotek, if that's what you're asking. But do I expect that there are going to be gimmicks in the fall election? Yeah. And the sad thing is, can I give you a great example? Italy is a country of about 60 million people, so like 14 times as many people as Oregon. they had an election for prime minister. They held the election in one day. They used conventional methods to count the ballots. I know you have to use computers too, but they managed to somehow produce the result in a single day. Oregon has vote by mail, where people may vote as much as 3 weeks before election day, and many of them return their ballots. And then on election day, we're told, oh, we won't possibly get results this day. Maybe we'll get them in a week. Maybe we'll get them in 10 days. Is there any good reason for there to be that kind of delay, unless it's just to provide an opportunity for cheating? Any good reason?
No, and I agree with you 100% on that. That's just what I was afraid of, especially with this close governor's race.
But it's a chicken and egg problem, Pete. I have people who say we can't get a fair election. I say, I agree with you. I think the elections are flawed. And I think vote by mail is a big part of the flaw. And then they say, well, how do we fix it? And I said, you have to elect a Republican governor and preferably a Republican secretary of state and a Republican legislature so they can dig into the problem, fix it. And if I had my druthers, go back to poll voting, where everybody shows up at the polls. I did it for years, shows their picture ID, signs their name in a book, gets one ballot and votes one time. If we would go back to that, they said that vote by mail was going to encourage a lot more voter participation. It has not. They said that vote by mail was going to be more convenient. It is not. They said that vote by mail was going to be secure. It is not. So, but the chicken and egg problem is, to fix the election, you have to elect a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. And if you said to me, and it's a reasonable objection, well, how do we do that when they've got the system so gimmicked that they can cheat? And I said, well, we have to win big enough that they can't cheat. And that's really the only way to do it. And I think Christine Drazen is pulling away from Tina Kotek right now. She's been ahead in every poll going back to June. Tina Kotek has trailed her, and the margin is getting bigger. And Betsy Johnson, who is, I guess, to some Republican rhinos, they said, well, we've got to back her, the former Democrat, pro-abortion Democrat. And I said, no, that's not the answer. And turns out that a lot of voters agree with me. That's why Betsy is trailing along at 18 or 19% in the polls. Polls aren't definitive. The only poll that is Election Day. But if she's at 18 or 19% and Kotek's at 30 and Drazen's at 35, you can tell who's going to win and you can tell who can't possibly catch up. Betsy Johnson is too far behind. So that's my answer to that. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. You've got the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. We'll do that in just a moment. Naysayers, of course, go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. We gave you two places to do it, just in case you don't like Twitter like me. Although, when Musk takes over and makes some changes, and it sounds like he's going to end up owning the show, I might just change my tune about Twitter. In any case, you can find the question at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. Now, remember the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, the Equal Rights Amendment was actually sent to the states back when I was still in junior high. It was that long ago. I'm sure some of you weren't even alive when the Equal Rights Amendment was sent off to the states. And they had 7 years to get it ratified. And you know what? The states, I think, sensibly said, nah, don't need it. We've got the Constitution. We don't need an amendment to it. Well, now it seems the Democrats in Congress are going to try to ignore the rules and the laws, as usual, and force through the ERA once again. Tom Gipping joins me now, who's deputy director of the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and a senior legal fellow at Heritage. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Would you mind bringing my audience up to date about what the Equal Rights Amendment actually proposes, whether or not you think it's needed or whether it's to a large extent irrelevant because of other federal laws and protections that have come in place since 1972? And why are the Democrats trying to revive this thing 50 years later?
Well, the Equal Rights Amendment was first proposed or first introduced in Congress in 1921. So more than 100 years ago, that was at the time when there were many discriminatory laws on the books, especially in the states. And the Supreme Court had interpreted the Constitution pretty narrowly. So the thinking was that state legislatures aren't going to do the right thing, and the courts aren't going to interpret the Constitution the right way unless we amend it, unless we actually put an amendment in the Constitution saying that men and women have equal rights. And you know, that idea was introduced in Congress in more than 1,000 resolutions over the next several decades. Lots of hearings, lots of debates about whether it was still needed, because legislatures started doing that on their own. The Supreme Court reinterpreted some parts of the Constitution to favor women on its own. And, you know, but by 1972, there was enough votes at least to send it to the states. As you said, they had 7 years, plenty of time. But enough states believed, A, we don't need it anymore, and B, it could do a lot of unintended damage, that not enough states, you need 38 states to ratify an amendment, not enough states ratified it. They even tried to extend the deadline a little bit by a few years, but when all was said and done, they had 35 states, not 38. I'm a lawyer, but I can do simple math. I know that 35 is less than 38, and it died in 1982. It died 40 years ago. Feminists, left-wing advocates still want it for a whole host of reasons that have nothing to do with why it was, you know, an idea in the first place. And so the last few years, 2017, Illinois passed a resolution supposedly ratifying it. 2018, Nevada did. In 2020, Virginia did. And they said, see, 35 plus 3 is 38. Now it's part of the Constitution. Well, you know, everybody knows what an expiration date is. And the expiration date for the ERA was 1982. So those three resolutions by those states were meaningless. So, of course, they went to court. Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals here in Washington considered whether, and that was an appeal brought by Illinois and Nevada. They had lost in the trial court, and they wanted the Court of Appeals to order the archivist of the United States. He's the official that keeps track of whether states are ratifying amendments and all of that. They wanted the court to order it, you know, into existence, even though Congress's rule was clear. The deadline was clear. It passed 40 years ago. And so, you know, we'll see what the Court of Appeals says. But the left wants it because even though it is no longer necessary, even though women have all the rights that men do, they want to use it for a whole host of other purposes, especially since the Supreme Court reversed Roe versus Wade. They want it to be a new foundation for abortion rights. They want it to support all kinds of things that are very controversial, and that's why they want to keep it alive.
I'm talking to Tom Gipping from the Heritage Foundation. Let me go back to the beginning, because I can do math at a very low level. But March of 72, they give them 7 years to ratify it. That should have meant that by 79, they were out of time. They got an extra 3 years out to 82, and then it died. So how can they argue that somehow, you know, adding to the ratification, you know, a couple of 40 years later, close to 40 years later, in somehow makes that legitimate? You'd think any court would just throw that one out on its face.
Well, and I forgot to mention that actually 5 of the 35 states that passed resolutions ratifying the ERA within a couple of years passed new resolutions withdrawing their support. So the ERA supporters say you cannot count the rescissions, but you must count the late entries, you know? The argument they make really sounds kind of silly, and that is when Congress set its 7-year deadline, when Congress votes on a constitutional amendment, they vote on a resolution that includes the language of the amendment, right?
Right.
And they send the resolution to the states. Well, they said the deadline is in the resolution, but it's not in the amendment itself. Therefore, it's invalid.
Tom, Congress has to sign off on an amendment to the Constitution, does it not? and they can choose how they want to. They could say, if you can get this ratified in the next 100 years, they could have set it as a 100-year deadline. If they'd wanted to, they didn't. They gave 7 years, which sounds like it's enough to actually allow all the state legislatures to consider it. But not so much that you just said, well, ratification sometime in the next century, which would, I think, be unreasonable. And they set a reasonable timeline and they put it in there. Without the Congress ratifying it with that language, the amendment never would have been considered by the states, would it?
Not only that, but at least 25 states that ratified the ERA explicitly said that that deadline was important in their decision. So it's like throwing dry spaghetti at the wall and hoping that it sticks. I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. It's kind of embarrassing to even describe it. So think of lawyers with a straight face trying to make this kind of an argument to the federal court. Last week, the Court of Appeals, you know, three judges, two of them were appointed by Democratic presidents, and all three of the judges were skeptical of this kind of an argument. It is a ridiculous argument. It's embarrassing, really. And even Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a pioneer for women's rights and who was a strong advocate of the ERA, she said in an interview several years ago, she said, look, the deadline's passed. I wish they would just start over.
Exactly.
And do it the right way.
Tom Gipping, who is with the Heritage Foundation, Deputy Director of the Ed Meese Center. We'll be back in a moment. Tom, thank you for the time. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, should Washington State go forward with plans to add 46 cents a gallon to gasoline taxes come January 1? That's just a few months from now. I would say no to that. And if you wonder, well, I didn't hear about a gas tax increase. Well, this one isn't specifically a gas tax. It's a cap and trade carbon tax, and it goes into effect January 1, 2023. It is estimated that it will add 46 cents per gallon, almost half a dollar, to the cost of a gallon of gasoline, on top of the state's already 49.4 cents per gallon in state gasoline taxes. So between the two taxes, it's just short of a dollar a gallon. And when you add the federal tax on top, that's I think it's about 18 cents, it's going to take it well over a dollar a gallon in taxes on gasoline that is already way too expensive because it more than doubled after Joe Biden became president and shut down oil drilling and canceled pipelines and all the rest of that. Might have even blown up that pipeline that Russia had, Nord Stream 2. But they want to add all this cost to gasoline. While they're telling you that they're very, very concerned about how people are doing, in the middle of an economic recession that's underway, in the middle of massive inflation, the likes of which the United States has not seen in 40 years, just as we're hearing today that OPEC has decided to cut its oil output by 2 million barrels a day. Now, the world uses a little bit over 100 million barrels a day. But when you cut 2% of the world's supply of a critical commodity like oil, you're going to make a difference. It's going to change prices, and I would expect you're going to see some of those price increases coming very, very soon. Joe Biden is not going to be able to hold off on it, although he is doing his best, it seems, to try to empty America's strategic petroleum reserve. You know, the reserve, the emergency supply of hundreds of millions of barrels of oil. The one that Joe Biden decided months ago that an emergency is when the Democrats appear to be losing the election that's coming up in 6 months. About 6 months ago, Joe Biden said, we're going to start drawing down the National Petroleum Reserve, a lot of which was filled at $30 a barrel. And now they're selling it, and yeah, they're going to make some more money out of it, but you're emptying an emergency supply that's supposed to be there just in case something really terrible happens, like a war, like an earthquake, like major disruption of supply chain, like the hurricane could have been. The hurricane did a gigantic amount of damage. Estimates run as high as $60 billion in Florida and some of the neighboring states. But if it had hit more directly on the Gulf instead of the Atlantic coast, it might well have disrupted refinery operations. That's when you go to that emergency supply, not just because Joe and the Democrats declare an emergency because they're about to lose an election and probably elections at the state level as well. So our Twitter poll is, should Washington State go forward with plans to add another 46 cents a gallon to gasoline costs? I would say no. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I got some interesting emails, but I'm really kind of disappointed. There was a young man who just called in from Seattle and apparently wanted to sound off. He's angry because conservatives are griping about the conditions in blue states like Oregon and Washington. Well, of course we're griping about it. The way you get things changed is by saying, no, don't raise the gas tax. No, don't raise other taxes. Hey, government, why don't you give back some of our money? I mean, just yesterday we were talking about the fact that the state of Washington is now granting literally billions of dollars in raises for its own employees instead of sending some of that money back to the people who paid it, the taxpayers, because the government will always tell you, however much money you send us, we're planning to spend every single dime of it, and then we're going to ask for more. So you've got public employees, and I understand, like everybody else, if you're a public employee, you want to get a bigger paycheck. Well, good for you. But what does it say when a state says raises for our employees come ahead of the economic well-being of the citizens of the state? Then what are you running? An operation that's supposed to benefit state employees before it benefits the citizens of that state? And I've also heard the argument that, well, if the kids aren't doing well in school, we have to spend more money on education. There has never been a study. There has never been a time where somebody could point and say, because we raised the payroll at the local school district, kids learned more. The two are not connected. And then I got this note from Les, who's writing in from Camas. He said, Lars, I've got an issue involving my disabled son. I went to U.S. Senator Patty Murray's Vancouver office, and nobody was there. I called and I left a voicemail. Her office called back to advise they have no staffing at her Vancouver office. I wonder if she's preparing to lose in November to Tiffany Smiley. I certainly hope so. Regards, Les. Now, I want to ask you this. Does it make any sense if you're a U.S. senator, you're given a budget to be able to rent office space so that you can be represented in your district? Does it make any sense to any of you to rent an office space that you don't plan to put any staff in? Is that the way Patty Murray has been spending your money? And do you really plan to vote to reelect her for one more term in the U.S. Senate? You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Vote my Twitter poll. You're going to find that two places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and also on our website at LarsLarson.com. I usually say if you're not crazy about Twitter, because I haven't been crazy about Twitter for the last few years, but now we find out that maybe Elon Musk is going to end up owning Twitter. He's going to make substantial changes to it. So maybe it's been good fortune that we have not decided to move the Twitter poll elsewhere, although most of the places we might move it, like Parler or Truth Social, a lot of people on Truth Social, I like Truth Social a lot, or on Gitter or one of those, they just don't have the technological side to be able to accommodate our poll. So, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we haven't moved it yet. But in any case, vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. I want you to consider a case that is really strange because it involves an absolutely gigantic hack of people's information. And I'll tell you that one of the biggest concerns I've got is that you're going to end up with somebody hacking into your computer, hacking into your personal information, taking control of your bank account or your credit cards or any of those things. I think most of us who are sensible try to take a lot of precautions to make sure that that kind of thing doesn't happen. But I've certainly interviewed people on the show who've had their personal data hacked. In some cases, they've had somebody impersonate them and doing it in a cyber way, which can be done from a distance. It's very difficult to catch those involved who've committed the crime. And it can be devastating to people because repairing the damage in some cases is close to impossible. So I want you to consider this case. It's a former Amazon engineer who hacked into credit card accounts, 100 million of them. Now, this happened about 3 years ago, but it turns out that this young lady, Paige Thompson, lives in Seattle, you know, which is a technology center in the United States. You've got Microsoft there. You've got Amazon there. She was convicted in June of this year on 7 hacking-related charges that involved the compromise of, as I said, 100 million credit card user accounts. And if you think about the kind of information that is included in those accounts, it's absolutely stunning how much somebody can find out about you. And once they have that information, it's not just a matter of, well, you call your bank and you kill that credit card and you get a brand new one. They may have compromised your credit. They may have compromised and even stolen money from you. But this young lady, Paige Thompson, was sentenced this week, sentenced yesterday, to time served and 5 years of probation for violating an anti-hacking law known as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Thompson is 37 years old and is responsible for one of the largest data breaches in U.S. history. So how is it that we have a law that's supposed to protect people? We have a law that says if you do these things and you're convicted, that we're going to go after you. And she ends up with time served and 5 years of probation, even though the hack involved 100 million credit card accounts, one of the largest in U.S. history. She downloaded data from more than 100 million Capital One users, including 120,000 Social Security numbers and about 77,000 bank account numbers. Now, as you understand, if somebody has your bank account number and the routing number and your name and your Social Security number and perhaps your date of birth, if that's not available online already, they've got everything they need to be able to strip every dime you have. Well, the U.S. attorney in the case, Nick Brown, says that Thompson, and this is where it makes the sentence make no sense at all, Thompson did $250 million in damage to companies and to individuals. And the prosecutors argued that Thompson had used a software tool that she built via Amazon Web Services that looked for misconfigured accounts. So this was not something that happened accidentally. This was not something where somebody just, inadvertently ran into some data. That happens from time to time. This is somebody who went out and built a piece of software to steal people's information, to look for accounts that were vulnerable. She then used the accounts to hack and download the data of more than 30 entities, including the banking company called Capital One. The bank's internal system recognized Thompson's queries as coming from a friendly computer, so it fulfilled her data requests. Arrested in July of 2019, Thompson remained jailed until November of that year. So she's in jail, for a few months, from July to November. At a sentencing hearing, the U.S. District Judge Robert Lasnik, appointed by Democrat President Bill Clinton, the horny hick from Arkansas, said that time in prison would be particularly difficult for Thompson because of her well-documented mental health issues and because she is, wait for it, folks, transgender. So she's a head case. She's got mental issues. I frankly don't care. She gets 6 months in jail and then, this is going to be really tough on her if we have to actually send her to prison the way the law provides. A jury in Seattle convicted her on counts of wire fraud, unauthorized access to a protected computer, damaging a protected computer. There was an 8-day trial where they laid it all out for the jury. The hearing to determine the restitution amount that Thompson has to pay is scheduled for the 1st of December, so just a couple of months from now. But imagine this. How much restitution is she going to be able to pay? If she did $250 million in damage, do you suppose that in an entire lifetime she could pay back 1/100th of that, $2.5 million? I would seriously doubt it. I mean, unless her skills are in huge demand, this young lady is going to get away with this. She violates a law. She's caught. She's convicted fair and square. She spends 6 months in jail, and the judge says, yeah, jail would be too tough on you. I would imagine that jail or prison would be tough on anybody who goes to jail or prison. But the idea that having done $250 million in damages to companies and individuals, that she gets the big punishment of, well, you're going to have to pay off some money. And, you know, an awful lot of these judgment accounts that they have against people, people pay almost nothing. I mean, in many cases, they just simply ignore it. Now, in theory, if you don't pay the restitution, you could go to prison. But she's not being sentenced to any prison. She's being sentenced to time served, and she'll have to be on probation for a while, which probably will get in the way of her making any serious amount of money to be able to pay back all the people she damaged. So when they tell you they need new laws to go after criminals, ask them if they're going to actually use the laws. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Black lives matter, white lives do not. Kanye West is messing up our plot. The BLM, that expression they own, let them break the law and stand alone, and stand alone. Kanye's preaching unity, a threat to race baiters like Jesse and me, Jesse and me. Kanye West, give him credit, I won't. 'Cause black lives matter and white lives don't. White lives don't.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's the great Jim Gossett, channeling a little bit of Al Sharpton right there. Glad to have your calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So over the weekend, Tina and I were running a number of errands. This is part of what we've been doing all summer. A lot of shovel work, a lot of bucket work, a lot of moving rocks because we're trying to get some landscaping done, and we're doing the work ourselves for the most part. There is some stuff that we do hire out because I don't know how to put in an irrigation system and things like that. But I pulled into the gas station. I said, hey, I got to fill this thing up. Cost over $100. Well, now we're finding out that it's going to get even worse because the gas prices that almost doubled, it very nearly doubled as the national average, started at $2.39 a gallon the day Joe Biden took the oath of office, nearly doubled to double that, and then fell back a little bit. And of course, Joe Biden, all the way up as the prices were increasing, kept saying, it's temporary, it's transitory, it's not going to be around long at all. Well, all the economists are now saying we're looking at long-term inflation and long-term recession at this point. And then we got the news today that the Saudis and the OPEC nations have now said we're going to cut back on production. So if they reduce the amount of oil by 2 million barrels a day, that's going to put even more pressure on at the pump. A huge block of the world's oil producers announced plans to cut production just as demand is rising. And, of course, that means that when they do that, prices are going to go up. And if they cut production for very long because the Saudis want to make money just like we do, you'd think the sensible thing for any administration to do, Joe Biden in this case, would be to say, we've got to make sure that America drills for its own oil. pumps its own oil, becomes self-sufficient, and ideally, since America right now, the United States of America, is effectively the Saudi Arabia of North America, we could be exporting fuel as well as having enough to meet all of our own demands. So you've got that as a major problem right now. And what does Joe Biden do? His energy secretary starts griping about, why won't the Saudis pump more? Now, I kind of figure that if the Saudis are watching some of these reports, they might be saying to each other, hey, why don't the Americans get their own oil? They've got a ton of it. They've got more oil than we do right now. Believe it or not, the United States has known reserves that are greater than those of Saudi Arabia. So wouldn't it seem a little bizarre that when you cut production, the people who've been buying it from you don't say, oh, heck, we've got our own oil. We don't really need yours. In fact, we can make bank on this. Let me point something out to you, that when Joe Biden came into office and he canceled most of the federal leasing on federal lands, one of the beautiful things for the American taxpayer, for the U.S. Treasury, and for our energy supply is that when the federal government leases lands that are owned by all of us, and they say to somebody, yes, you can come and drill on this piece of land, the company that, or the individual, in many cases, small mom and pop operations, that when they get permission from the federal government to drill on a piece of land, they pay for that privilege. And you pay whether you find anything or not. It's kind of like buying a tag to go hunting for elk or deer, because you buy the tag and you have a chance, but there's no guarantee you're going to find anything. Well, that's the deal. And then if you find something on federal lands, 15% of everything you get goes to the U.S. Treasury. That's the royalty they charge. So if you find, say, $1 billion worth of oil on federal lands, and you've already paid hundreds of thousands, if not millions, for the privilege of then putting $5 and $10 million holes in the ground to try to find the oil, if you find $1 billion, you owe $150 million of that to the U.S. Treasury. So it's a sweet deal for the American taxpayer. These are lands that all of us own. And if the government went out to drill for the oil, you can imagine how that would go. It would run like most other government operations, like Amtrak or the post office or the DMV. But if you have private sector individuals who put their own money up to drill for that oil, but the deal is if you find anything, Uncle Sugar owns 15%. So that would be a great deal. Joe Biden doesn't like that. And his energy secretary, they love the idea that Saudi Arabia will pump more so that we can be dependent on the Middle East, so that we can be and were dependent on Russia, so that we can be dependent on countries like Venezuela instead of having our own. Second problem, there's a new report out. You know that at the beginning of this year, mortgage interest rates for people who want to buy a home were at just above 3%. Mortgage interest rates have now gone up again. And according to Bloomberg, U.S. mortgage rates have now risen for 7 weeks in a row. They are now at the highest point they have been in 16 years. Mortgage interest rates have gone up 1.3 percentage points. The practical effect of that is that everybody who might want to buy a house, well, there's a big chunk of that group who now can't buy a house at all because they're priced out of the marketplace. Because in given cities, depending on where you live, in the area where I live, average house is north of $500,000. If that's the average house, you can only get to such a point where you say, well, I'm looking for a $450,000 house. You'll take one with a few warts on it. And if you get down to there and you can't go any lower there, and the interest rates have now topped 6 percentage points to get a mortgage, then you just may be told by your banker and by your real estate agent, I'm sorry, you won't be able to buy a house at all. And then third problem, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Well, Joe Biden decided we were in an emergency and he had to empty this thing. So he's emptying it. We are now at the lowest level we have been in decades. And what they've been pumping out is relatively inexpensive oil that was put in. And in fact, if you consider this, in March of 2020, the election year, Democrats, including Kamala Harris in the U.S. Senate at the time, blocked President Trump from filling the reserve when the oil prices were low. And then in January of last year, Joe Biden said, well, we're going to make energy prices go up. And then in November of last year, Joe Biden said, okay, we're going to start taking oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We've now taken the reserve to the lowest level in several decades, and gas prices are still high. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larsen Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larsen Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment, but sometimes there are stories that get so complicated that I've got to get some professional help. I need an expert opinion when it comes to interest rates. Now, I understand the simple stuff. I even have my own point of view, whether it's, whether Peter Earle would agree with it or not, that the Fed is constantly saying why it's our job to make sure that when the economy slows down, we put on the gas. And when the economy speeds up too much being defined by the Fed, that is their job to step on the brakes. I'm not sure, I'm not even necessarily persuaded that either of those activities by the Fed has actually worked out well, although I'm open to persuasion. But Peter Earle, who is an economist and a writer with the American Institute for Economic Research, Peter, welcome to the program. I want to ask you about this most recent news that, the Fed has been saying we've got to make sure that the economy, we curb inflation, which I think is being caused by government spending to the and supply chain to some extent. But now the UN has weighed in saying to the Fed, no. If you keep raising interest rates to try to curb inflation in America, it might end up being bad for other countries. And I'll admit right up front, my bias is, while I'm concerned about other countries, I want the first priority of the actions of our government and pseudo-government agencies like the Fed to be the best in the best interests of Americans. Welcome back to the program, by the way.
Thanks, Lars. It's good to be here. So we got this please, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so can you sort this out for me, please? Because all of this has real consequences on you, on me, and everybody listening to this show as the Fed either does or doesn't take these actions.
Right. So there was a report that came out from the UN Council on Trade and Development. And I'll just cut to the chase by starting with the UN is a pretty reliable source of bad ideas. In particular, when they make economic policy recommendations, they really shine. So they've basically said that if the Fed continues to raise interest rates, they're going to trigger a recession in other countries. And there's at least three things that are very wrong with that. First of all, even before my things, let me just say I agree with you. I'm not sure that I want them. We strive to have a politically independent Fed. The idea that there is some implicit pressure by Congress or the prevailing administration in the United States, but the idea that foreign nations or groups of them or multi-governmental agencies would try to influence the Fed is just I think it's appalling. And there's really three kind of irksome things about this idea. I can get if you'd like me to.
Please do.
Sure. So the first is that the one reason that the UN says or is citing for this reason to stop raising interest rates is that other countries have high debt levels. And so the idea that inflation should be allowed to run because other nations can't live within their means is just ridiculous. Okay, so that's the first one.
Agreed.
The second is that the UN is implicitly choosing rising inflation over slowing growth. So I don't know where they've been, but actually we've had slowing growth since before March when the Fed started raising interest rates. So that was coming anyway. But you can have a recession without having inflation. And the UN, if they are as concerned as they claim to be about the world's poor and about underdeveloped nations and all that stuff, the idea of having a recession and then also having the purchasing power in those nations and of the dollar, which is used everywhere, declining, it's a way, way worse idea. I mean, they are really talking about opening up a whole new level of pain for some of these countries. And then I guess the third one would be, the worst of all is that they have recommended, the UN in this report, that is, they've recommended that instead of raising interest rates, that the Fed stop, and instead that we put on price controls, and that we put on and that we do more fiscal expansion. Now, I have to tell you, for me personally as an economist, whenever I hear an individual, a government body, whatever, recommend price controls, it's a one-shot litmus test for economic ignorance. And the Fed really has met that criteria hands down. Price controls always make things worse. We tried that under Nixon. Other countries have tried it, and they always wind up disastrous.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Nixon because, look, Nixon did it, wage and price controls, and I don't even know why. I mean, I was a kid when they did that, but I remember thinking, this doesn't make any sense. I had a high school teacher who was from Russia. I mean, his family was from Russia, and he said, yeah, in Russia, they'll say shoes are $2 a pair, you know, back in the day, and you'd say, and but you'd get in line, and you'd find out, yeah, they're $2 a pair, but there aren't any available. And I've used that example. I've said to people, why don't if we can control prices, why don't we set the price of gasoline at $2 a gallon? Now there won't be any for sale at $2 a gallon, but the official nationwide price will be $2. And you, I guess, you can feel warm and fuzzy. We've got $2 gas. Now you can't buy any at that price, but that's the official price. That's the insanity they're buying into, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's this idea that if you set price controls, that money is going to only go towards that purpose and nothing else. In fact, what happens is when you set price controls, what happens is people who can't acquire those goods you just mentioned, they tend to disappear. They will go into other areas, and then you get price increases that are, you know, outside the norm there. And after a while, it's just this sort of like conveyor belt process of more price controls, more price controls, more distortions, less availability, increasingly bad allocations of resources, and before you know it, you have far worse of a problem than you started with.
Well, and I'd be lying if I didn't admit, I mean, when you were talking about countries that can't live within their means, the U.S. government is doing that right now. I would caveat that by saying you're like that guy or gal who has too many credit cards and they're too full, but you always make the minimum payment. So I guess as long as it's your crazy idea to spend beyond your means, go ahead as long as you make the payments. We've never defaulted. But this is the UN saying we should keep interest rates low so other countries, not like the United, not with the gigantic economic engine that the U.S. has, should be able to keep on borrowing like crazy and running their debts up even more when they're already very much underwater. That doesn't make any sense. In fact, is that good long term, or is the UN just saying, yeah, let them run up their debts, and then at some point the big countries will say, okay, we'll forgive your debts, and you get to zero out your balances, like somebody who, you know, gets a lot of credit cards and then declares bankruptcy every 7 years?
Yeah, I mean, what they're recommending is completely, completely irresponsible. I mean, it's not our job to run the interest rate on their debts up, but I'm not going to I would never recommend subverting the interest of Americans or any, you know, other people who use the dollar to, you know, third world countries or developing nations who, for whatever reason, got really behind on their debt, and now interest rates are rising. I mean, all you have to do is look at a 50-year sort of history of interest rates to know that, you know, 1 or 2%, 0% is not normal. So they were going to go up eventually.
So what do we do instead, and how do we answer the UN? Because I agree with you, the UN is just chock full of bad ideas. But is our government, our globalists in the government, including Joe Biden, are they going to be entranced by this idea? Yeah, we should do what the UN says.
They may, but I mean, you know, we mentioned that the UN is a never-ending source of bad ideas. It's not really surprising because the whole idea is utopian, right? I mean, any organization that claims it has that every different nation on every continent all over the world has the same interest and the same wherewithal is utopian, right? The whole reason international trade works, right, the whole reason that I can get avocados and other people in other countries can get American products is because the 190 or so nations don't have parallel interests. We don't have the same resources. And the very idea of turning our natural variation in the world into and the miracle of comparative advantage into a single point of failure is just, it's just awful. It's a liability. I don't know what the administration's response will be, but I hope it would be that they smile and nod and kind of shrug and we just stay the course.
Yeah. Thanks for your suggestion. We'll be doing what's best for Americans. Although, I guess, Mr. Earle, asking Joe Biden to do what's best for Americans, I would think that if he was doing that, he wouldn't be going hat in hand to our Saudi Arabian friends and asking them for more oil. He'd say, hey, thanks, Saudi. We've got a whole bunch at home. We're set. But Joe's not going to do that either because he's got a bunch of greenie friends at home as well. That's Peter Earle, who's an economist and a writer at the American Institute for Economic Research. He helps me understand these more complicated issues. Back in just a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. and the Radio Northwest Network. That's right. It is the Lars Larson Show, and it's the Radio Northwest Network as well, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Valhalla Tea Company. It's made by veterans to help veterans by donating $1 from every bag sold at ValhallaTea.com. Our Twitter poll today: should Washington State go forward with plans to add 46 cents a gallon to gasoline taxes? It's going to be a cap and trade tax that is set to add an estimated 46 cents per gallon, almost half a dollar, on January 1, just a few months from now. I would say no, that's a crazy idea. Now, if Jay Inslee, the governor, does not declare it crazy, if the lawmakers in Olympia, both Democrats and Republicans, do not say, we got to put the brakes on this one, save it for another time. But do not hit our people in our state with another almost half a dollar on top of the already half a dollar, 49.4 cents per gallon in state gas taxes, plus another 18 cents in federal gas taxes, all of that on top of people who are in the middle of some of the worst inflation we've seen in 40 years. If that makes sense to anybody, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Richard, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, a few months back, you were a gentleman came on talking about Sam Bankman-Fried. I believe he was financing campaign for Jamie Herrera Butler.
Yep.
And I wanted to let you know that he's the second largest campaign contributor to Joe Biden's campaign for presidency.
I believe it.
So number one, he's a bad actor. And number two, he's currently working with Chuck Schumer in the Senate to put up a bill to create something that's called a bit license, which is basically going to stifle cryptocurrency innovation in the United States. It's going to
know that this Sam Bankman-Fried, this is a guy who's made literally billions of dollars in cryptocurrency. And now that he's one of the big players, he wants to put limits on it. I would argue, he'd probably argue, well, this is to protect everybody. But it's what every big player does, is put limits on it.
Yeah.
So the big players do well. They handle the limits just fine. And the little players get squeezed out. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. But there's another gentleman out there. His name is Ben Armstrong. And he's a guy I listen to. He's a red-blooded, Jesus-loving American. And he has his YouTube program, Bitway Crypto, and he's doing counter legislation with other legislators out there and trying to do his own lobbying in there and trying to get his own bill through. And I'm just trying to do my part in getting the word out there, because they were doing this under the radar and trying to do it, you know, in behind closed doors and all that kind of stuff. And he exposed it and set it out, you know, let everybody know about it, and he's really upset about it. I was just trying to get a hold of Ben Armstrong and do an interview with
him.
Well,
I'll tell you what, I think it'd be interesting. I mean, you've done a very good commercial for the other show you like, but I mean, my concern is that when these people with huge amounts of money decide to get involved in politics, they become the market maker in some ways. And you know there's a reason they want to back people running for Congress, because if they can get their ears early on by saying, I'm the guy or I'm the gal who helped you get into the Congress, now you have to listen to me, and I want you to be able to put these bills up. And I think in many cases, Congress doesn't understand crypto. I'm not sure I could. I mean, I understand part of it, but when they do that and they say, let's have a bunch of rules, this is why I'm always suspicious when Microsoft or any of the other big players say, we'd like to have more regulation, because big players, whether it's big banks or big tech agencies, have less problem handling those new regulations than the small players.
Absolutely.
And they tend to lock the small players out, which means the small players just really don't have a chance. Thanks very much. I appreciate the call. 866, hey Lars, that's 866-439-5277. By the way, I want to mention one thing out of Oregon. Last night, as Kristen writes in, and I saw this story earlier today, didn't have time to mention it before then. Last night, the Bend Lapine School Board fired three of its teachers. And if you wonder, well, hold on a second. Aren't we short of teachers right now? Yeah, we're short of teachers. We're short of highway workers. We're short of medical workers. And why are they being fired? Again, because of vaccine mandates. One of them, as Kristen points out, is a 26-year veteran teacher and coach because they won't comply with the vaccine mandates. Now, I got to tell you something. Just yesterday, I saw some brand new numbers that are out. All of the folks who are enthusiastic about the vaccines, I'm not, have said, well, everybody has to get vaccinated. Right now, the public opinion polls show that maybe 50% of the American public plans to get vaccinated. Some of them are even off the usual flu shots every fall. If we're still firing people from critical jobs, whether it's at schools, at the Department of Transportation, or any other place, we're firing people that we very much need to have on the job because they won't take the jab, then what you're doing is you are shortchanging the citizens. You're turning around and saying, hey, by the way, we would like to have more of these people. Then stop firing them for not taking the shot. Drop the vaccine mandates. Let Americans make their own decision, and we're all going to be a whole lot better off. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.